So good, so good, so good.
New markdowns up to 70% off are at Nordstrom Rack stores now. Stock up and save big on shoes, tops, dresses, accessories, and more must-haves for summer. Join the Nordy Club to unlock exclusive discounts, shop new arrivals first, and more. Plus, buy online and pick up at your favorite Rack store for free. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
Ready to soundtrack your summer? With Red Bull Summer All Day Play, you choose a playlist that fits your summer vibe the best. Are you a festival fanatic, a deep end DJ, a road dog, or a trail mixer? Just add a song to your chosen playlist and put your summer on track. Red Bull Summer All Day Play. Red Bull gives you wings. Visit redbull.com/brightsummerahead to learn more. See you this summer.
Hey, Kusha, have you ever seen those videos of like how to reorganize your fridge?
I haven't, but it sounds like the kind of content I wish were in my feed. Tell me more.
There's a lot of fridge content in my feed. So, you know, the idea is basically that the way a lot of our American fridges are, you put all the vegetables and fruit, stuff spoils easily in the drawers where you can't see it. And the shelves are for condiments and things that you don't really need to see all the time. And so there are some people who advocate for reorganizing your refrigerator contents, where you put things like condiments or drinks or whatever in the drawers so that the produce and things that go bad is front and center.
Oh.
And so the thinking is that this helps you eat more of that stuff. And your leftovers are supposed to go like literally front and center when you open the door. And it helps reduce food waste.
Ariana Brocious, have you tried this yourself?
a little. I admit I am not. I have not adopted the whole methodology, but I do try to put things I want to eat, like leftovers and stuff, right as soon as I open it, so that I remember and I go for those first instead of, you know, forgetting and letting them rot in the back of the fridge.
Behavioral economics, baby. It's food for thought.
It's a thing.
I want your Instagram login information. Mine is like cars driving fast and video games. No. And KitchenAid mixers getting repaired. I'm a big fan of repairing videos. But that's for another episode, another podcast. I'm Kusha Navadar.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
And this is Climate One.
Food loss and waste account for as much as 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions and cost $1 trillion annually, according to the United Nations. But here's the number that gets me. About a third of all food grown on the planet gets wasted rather than eaten.
I've heard that fact before, but every time I hear it, it is just staggering. We know that in developing countries, waste usually occurs between the field and the store because of things like poor infrastructure, lack of refrigeration, and broken supply chains.
Whereas in rich countries, most waste happens after food reaches the store, where consumers don't want to buy imperfect food, or they buy too much and don't eat it all before it spoils. This is a thing that, unfortunately, we are all familiar with.
Yes. Don't make me go look in my vegetable bin.
Yeah, I'm guilty too. Definitely have some slimy lettuce in my fridge right now.
Okay, Ariana, first, ew. But second, literally one of the reasons I got into smoothies last year was just so I could dump all of the spinach and bananas that were about to turn into something in the moment. It's been a huge factor for me, just like trying to stop food waste.
You're an inspiration to us all.
Thank you. I know.
So imagine how much pollution and deforestation and starvation we could reduce if we got this problem under control at scale.
This week, we look at three companies with fresh takes on tackling food waste, some with the help of artificial intelligence, which is cool to me because I spent some time working with AI years ago when it was much more scrappy, and now it's really developed into a useful tool.
Yeah, I will admit to being a pretty big AI skeptic. I'm still pretty concerned about generative AI's water and energy use and the way that AI in general seems to be sneaking into all parts of our lives.
100%.
But I will say, hearing about some of the ways these companies are using AI to reduce food waste is pretty encouraging.
You're probably familiar with Nest, the first smart home thermostat.
Nest's co-founder, Matt Rogers, went on to co-found another company called Mill. They make a home food recycler. Now the company is expanding to AI-enhanced commercial-scale recyclers that'll turn food waste from Whole Foods stores into chicken feed, which will then get fed to Whole Foods chickens.
Matt Rogers joined Climate One's Greg Dalton for a conversation in front of a live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Rogers recalled how living through Hurricane Andrew at age 10 started his journey into climate and environmental awareness.
I actually remember it like it was yesterday. It was a pretty pivotal point in my life and actually my climate journey. So I grew up in Gainesville, Florida, which is kind of right in the middle of the state. And we didn't really have very many hurricanes. On the coast, they had quite a few.
Sure.
But Hurricane Andrew was pretty ferocious. And we had these glass skylights over our living room. And I remember the glass literally like leaving the house and like in the rain pouring in the home. And, whoa, you know, my parents having to explain kind of what was going on and why. And, you know, that was like a storm of the century.
Pretty scary for a 10-year-old.
It was really scary for a 10-year-old. But then we had several more like that. When you have a storm of a century every couple of years or every year, that's when you start to take note.
Yeah. You're probably best known for co-founding Nest, the thermostat company. When you co-founded Nest, what was your inspiration for doing that?
I've always been a builder. You know, even as a child, I loved to build things. And when I was at Apple in the 2000s building iPods and iPhones, it became very clear that technology was changing. And the power that we had in our hands, you know, what eventually became the iPhone was remarkable. And the things in our home didn't look at all like that. I was living in a townhouse in Los Gatos and, you know, I had the most beige things on the wall that you can imagine from Honeywell, probably from the 1980s.
You got to squint at them to see the numbers.
It literally made no sense. Yeah, like the guys who were making the iPhone living with these beige plastic boxes on their wall, it was very, very clear that we could build something a lot better. So my then boss at the time, Tony Fadell, and I, we left and, you know, we started on what we thought was the most important thing in the home, which was heating and cooling. And a lot of folks kind of laughed at us at the time. Like, hey, like the inventors of the iPhone are working on air conditioning?
Furnaces are not sexy.
They're not, but actually they're really important. You know, at the time, I think the stats are still true. Heating and cooling is about half of the energy we use at home. Mm. It's a massive part of our global footprint and it's a huge cost for folks. So it made a lot of sense to put the A team on it.
And you sold that to Google for $3.2 billion. You're close to 30 years old. What was that like, you know, letting go of your baby and hitting that kind of at such an early age?
I tend to not celebrate wins when they happen. I kind of just move on to the work on the next thing. Hmm. And I stayed at Google for another 5 years to help build and shepherd that business. But at the same time, also, you know, especially reflecting on my upbringing, my wife and I spent a lot of time on how we could give back. And after we sold the company to Google, we almost immediately started a family foundation. We started doing impact investing and really leaned into climate in a very big way.
Yeah, and we'll get to some of that impacting, that different part, political, philanthropy, et cetera. So you're fabulously wealthy, you're 30 years old, you create this cool thing, you took something that's kind of, you know, ancient and made it cool and hip, and then you decide to go to food waste and chicken feed. Explain that one for me.
It's kind of the same thought process. You know, we look at our waste every day and we think we can't do much about it. It's one of these things that it's a daily problem. Mm-hmm. And we all kind of take it for granted. And the way my brain is wired is to look at those kinds of things and think differently. So in the middle of the pandemic in 2020, when we were kind of living all in our own waste and my house was full of fruit flies, it was very obvious that there could be a better way. And I spent a lot of time on Zooms and phone calls with my now co-founder, Harry, talking about, could we do something quite different? And through many twists and turns, that's what eventually led to the starting of Mill.
Right. There's food waste at all stages, from the farm, at the store, in the refrigerator. I'm sure there's some moldy hummus in my refrigerator right now. You know, we make enough food. It's a tragedy. We make enough food to feed the world, but it doesn't get to the right places. And so much of it's wasted.
Yeah, we waste about 40% of the food we grow. which is astonishing.
It's
embarrassing. And all of our parents and grandparents told us growing up not to waste food.
Yeah.
But yet we do. I think I'll get this close to right. We waste about $400 billion a year in the U.S. on food waste. Like, that's like the amount of food we throw out.
Yeah.
It's like more than the GDP of most countries.
Right. And so you chose to attach, not surprisingly, the consumer-facing part of that, right? A lot of people have those little green composting things, which are all right.
Yeah, they're kind of awful. And that's what we started Mill. And, you know, going back to how I thought about building Nest, you know, you start with the most important and the hardest thing first. Because if you could do the hardest thing first, you know, you could do anything after that. So we started with building a product for people at home to make it easy to recycle food. And, you know, I had one of those compost pails on my counter and my house was full of fruit flies. So we set out to design a product that was beautiful, never smelled, and incredibly easy and fun to use. Something that people would actually use every day.
Right. Okay. And you're calling this food recycling or composting? Is there a difference?
I'm using different words on purpose. So composting is a natural process that, you know, takes organic matter and kind of returns it to the soil as a kind of soil additive, as a fertilizer. Food recycling is something that effectively we are inventing, in that we're creating multiple pathways for food to be recycled. Either food could go to compost and feed the soil, or food could go to animal feed and feed animals. Food could actually also be used to make energy. There's mm-hmm. lots of things we could do with food. So we're actually trying to make a bigger category than just composting.
Okay. I think I've read something like 3-4% of food is composted in this country. It's very small, but a growing number of jurisdictions, cities, counties have some curbside collection. There's laws in California, Vermont. So for those who have curbside collection, it gets collected by a truck. It goes often trucked far away. Industrial composting, right? Okay, so that creates sort of black gold and it comes back to those cities. So are you trying to displace that? Are you saying you're better than that? Or you're just an alternative for people who don't have that option?
We looked at where else in the world things are working better. And South Korea, I think, is the best in the world at handling waste. I think maybe it's a matter of national security. They're a peninsula and they import calories. So in South Korea, 95% of their food gets recycled, either into animal feed to feed chickens and pigs or to feed the soil. And we looked at kind of the elements of that system and we said, what are the things that we could build here in a kind of in a U.S. context that better fit our lives? And part of that was a product for our homes, but also part of it is a system, you know, a ability to collect this material, get it to its highest and best use in your local community.
You say it's nicer and better than the green pail that some people have. Put food scraps in there. Then what happened? It dehydrates it, right? It's not actually composting it, so it takes the water out. And then what?
Yeah. So part of our special sauce, you know, as product designers, is can we make a product that is easy and fun that you'll actually want to use? And the technology that we ended up going with is dehydration. And the reason why is what makes food waste gross is when it gets wet and gloopy, when it starts to rot and grow mold and attracts fruit flies. When you take the water out of food, all that gross stuff stops. But also what's nice is it gets light and airy, it's easy to transport, it doesn't go bad, it's shelf stable. So what we actually found almost by accident in solving the grossness problem is a new way to make logistics possible. You know, part of what makes food waste difficult to manage as a society and why we don't often have green bins at our curb to collect food waste is because it's very expensive, because it's wet and it goes bad really fast.
Okay, so I put this in here, it's dehydrated, and then are you going to collect it from me or I'm going to put it in my garden? Because part of the dehydration is you've also removed some of the nutrient and the value, biological value of that by taking the water out.
So what's great about dehydration is actually it keeps all the nutrients in there. Like all the calories, the micronutrients and the macronutrients are all still there. What stops is the clock on it going bad, it rotting. So what's nice now is you have lots of different options and things to do with this. A lot of our customers, most of our customers, actually use it in their own gardens at home. They use it as a soil additive, as a fertilizer. For those who don't have a garden, you could put it in your municipal green bin, something that's happening more and more in the country. For those who don't have any options, Mill actually built a collection system so that people could get this food waste back to a great place for it to be recycled.
And you also have a partnership with Whole Foods to turn their fruit, vegetables, and scraps into chicken feed.
Oh, yeah. This is really exciting. So we started with the hardest thing, which is, can we solve it at home? But we always envisioned doing this at mega scale. And grocery stores waste a ton of food. Actually, literally, like about a ton per store per day, which is astonishing to think about. So, yeah, we're working with Whole Foods as our first customer, but actually many more customers coming on a much larger scale mill and the entire full recycling loop to get it back into chicken feed or to feed the soil.
That makes sense for them because they take waste and make an input. I also want to get just for a moment back to the curbside. You have a life cycle analysis on your website, which is the idea of the sort of looking at the inputs, how customers use it. You know, is this better than the alternative? And I couldn't really understand it. So I asked a professor at UC Berkeley who basically said, if you have your own yard for composting or curbside collection, keep doing that because that exists. But if you don't have that option, mill can offer incremental reduction in climate harming emissions. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. So most folks don't realize that when food waste goes in the trash, it's not a neutral thing. It's an actively bad thing.
Really bad.
When food waste goes to landfill, it degrades anaerobically and creates methane. And for those who don't know, methane is like 80 times worse than CO2 from a warming perspective.
Super pollutant.
Super pollutant, super bad. So, you know, keeping food waste at a landfill is paramount. So that's why we kind of go to extra efforts to create all these different pathways and ways of using food waste instead of just throwing it in the trash.
Indeed. I recently went to Recology, where recycling is collected here in San Francisco, and they have humans taking out the bad things from the stream. Then they have these AI things picking out the things of high value, metals. So there's human and AIs doing the recycling part. You're kind of the parallel part with food. How does AI fit in?
AI has been a remarkable tool for our industry. So we're building a camera into our commercial scale mill bin. And what it's able to do is provide a real-time stream of what's being thrown away. So if you think about for a grocery store, they can start getting real-time information on what's being thrown away, then act on that information. And AI could automatically say, oh, we ordered too many bananas this Thursday. Next Thursday, now we know let's order fewer bananas. Or for our hot bar, we're throwing away a lot of biscuits. We need to bake fewer biscuits because we're wasting that many and people aren't buying them. So AI is allowing us to effectively prevent waste from happening, which is ultimately the best thing we could do. You know, getting at that $400 billion that we just talked about wasted food, ultimately we want to prevent wasted food altogether.
Now realize that, you know, AI is not one thing. It's kind of this umbrella term. And there's predictive AI, which could make, you know, weather forecasts or cancer screenings. And there's generative AI, which uses a lot of energy to produce fake videos and other things. So you're leaning into AI as a force for good. So how worried are you about AI's negative impacts, knowing what you know about technology and energy and climate?
I mean, I've been working with AI for a long time. I've been working on it before it was called AI. You know, back in the Nest days, we called it machine learning. Mm-hmm. And we launched the Nest Learning Thermostat. You know, technology is a tool. And really, like, you know, the value of the technology is in the hands of the people who are building it. And it's incumbent on us as entrepreneurs, as technology leaders, to use technology for good.
So many climate solutions require behavior change. And this has been really hard to get a large number of people to do a little, eat a little less, drive a little less, you know, these nudges. So what have you learned and what actually makes people, you know, make change versus just kind of virtue signaling or expressing concern?
I've been working on behavior change my entire career, actually. You know, going back to my time at Apple, my work at Nest, you know, for those who've had Nest thermostats at home, that green leaf that you saw on the dial was a little nudge to kind of send you in the direction of saving energy.
And does that work? Is that only work to a certain, that's a carrot, or it's a I don't know, identity reinforcer, a little bit of virtue signal?
It does work. So again, I've been out of Nest for a while, almost a decade now, but Nest thermostats save about 20% off your heating and cooling bill. So they save quite a bit of energy. But really, when it comes to behavior change, the key is to make things better. And you know, Nest thermostat is better than what came before. A mill bin is better than a countertop compost pail. An electric car is better than a gas car.
For sure.
A Beyond Meat burger is worse than a hamburger. And that is why people do not eat them.
Right. It has to be better. People will go for better. They won't necessarily go for more virtuous.
That's right. Yeah. Virtue signaling gets you a little bit, but really that does not get you widespread behavior change. And I think about when you mentioned, you know, don't eat meat. When one day we might have plant-based meats or cultured meats that taste as good and are as nutritious, but that is not where we are today.
And by cultured meat, you mean like lab-grown actual cells. It's like a beef without a cow, but it's grown in a lab.
That's right. Beef without a cow is a great way of putting it.
Right. And there's tuna without a fish and, you know, all sorts of things. That was kind of in vogue for a while recently, not so much lately. Is that something you see as promising?
You know, with my other hats on, as a technology investor and philanthropist, these are still categories that we invest in that still exist. They're still very early stage and are still very expensive. But the idea is that one day, you know, as the technology improves, as things scale, one day a lab-grown hamburger will be, you know, as cost-effective as a cow who's raised in the field.
Right.
But we're not there yet.
Right. And put a lot of ranchers out of work and have a lot less emissions. And they could, yeah. There's a dominant narrative that Silicon Valley is no longer investing in green tech or clean tech for lots of different reasons. There's been a couple of, I guess, waves of a lot of money from Silicon Valley going into clean energy, then it pulls back and it comes back in again. What are you seeing right now?
We are changing the words, but we're still doing the work. And I think about the last time this happened. So the clean tech 1.0 boom and bust. We started Nest just in that kind of time of bust. And we never called Nest a clean tech company. Yeah, you know, we were building a thermostat and the primary purpose was to help people save energy, but we never called it a clean tech company. And I think about, you know, Mill.
Why not?
Why not? Because it's really about identifying what people are buying is and what the category is and, you know, how you think about shopping. Things like clean tech or IoT, these are like investor words.
Internet of things.
Yeah, these matter very little to normal people. Okay. You know, the average person doesn't buy something because it's a clean tech product. They buy it because it's going to be helpful and valuable to their family.
Okay. And so you say Silicon Valley still investing in green. So is that example of, is there green hushing? People are doing it, but they're not talking about it.
Or we're calling it what it is. You know, we're working on energy, or we're working on transportation, or working on food and agriculture. You know, all these things contribute to the climate and the environment, but they're just a much more focused way of talking about it.
So if you were pitching Nest or Mill today, would you use different language?
I mean, the way I talk about my company today is I'm building a waste technology company. And you know, inherently, by reducing waste and preventing waste, we're doing a good thing for the planet.
And Americans like technology. They don't like waste. Okay. And you're solving a problem.
It's a very bipartisan thing to do. There's actually no pro-waste group out there.
Because everyone had a mother who said, don't waste.
That's right. And actually, with Mill today, I spend a lot of time in D.C. working with folks on both sides of the aisle. It's a completely bipartisan thing. Yeah, everyone out there is saying we should prevent food waste and we should do the right thing with food.
We'll hear more from Nest and Mill co-founder Matt Rogers after a break. I have to say, dropping off my stinky, sloppy bucket of compost at the city collection site every week is my least favorite chore. So a dehydrator food recycler like Mill sounds great. But if the goal is to make this standard for American households, the price tag is going to prevent a lot of people from buying one because they currently retail for $1,000.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot. Well, our goal here is really to highlight the big ideas and not one particular product. And there are other similar products that you can get for less.
Coming up, Matt Rogers on the role of philanthropy and investment in amplifying the talent we need to create solutions.
We have so much climate work we need to do. Health work, you know, social inequality, education. There are so many issues we have as a society. This is literally what philanthropy was designed to do.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You know those friends who support your preference for podcasts over music on road trips? That's the energy State Farm brings to insurance. With over 19,000 local agents, they help you find the coverage that fits your needs so you can spend less time worrying about insurance and more time enjoying the ride. Download the State Farm app or go online at statefarm.com. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Zootopia 2 has come home to Disney Plus.
Let's go!
Get ready for a new case.
We're gonna crack this case and prove we're the greatest partners of all time!
New friends.
You are
Gary the Snake.
And your last name?
The Snake.
Dream team.
In new habitats.
Zootopia has a secret reptile population.
You can watch the record-breaking phenomenon at home.
You're clearly working it.
Zootopia 2. Now available on Disney Plus, rated PG.
Get business done with the new American Express Graphite Business Cash Unlimited card. With unlimited 2% cash back on all eligible purchases,
unlimited 5% cash back on flights and prepaid hotels booked through American Express Travel Online, and a flexible spending capacity that can grow with your business, you'll have the confidence to keep building. Apply today and earn a welcome offer of $1,500 cash back after you spend $50,000 in qualifying purchases on your new card within the first 6 months of card membership. Terms apply. Learn more at go.amex/graphite.
Let's get back to Greg Dalton's conversation with Matt Rogers, co-founder of Nest, the smart thermostat, and Mill, a food recycler. They chatted in front of a live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco.
Along with running Mill, you run an investment philanthropy and an activism organization called Insight. So tell me how you juggle these different hats and how you think of those things fitting together, you know, advocacy, philanthropy, and impact investing.
So it all comes down to, at the core, around talent and trying to help talent working on really important problems for society with all the different tools we could provide. And a lot of my colleagues forget how many tools could exist. Either they're only investors, or they're only entrepreneurs, or they only run a foundation and do nonprofit work. My wife and I try to think quite creatively about finding talent in all aspects of society, whether they're building companies, working in government, doing research, and trying to give them the tools, whether they're financial tools, support, mentorship, connections, to help them accomplish their dreams.
And so in finding talent, how much of that is letting go of control, even though you're providing some resources?
For me, it's actually the opposite of control. It's really about enabling. And you know, when we find a great entrepreneur or social entrepreneur or activist out there, they're on a mission. And you know, if we could provide rocket fuel to them, they could get to their dream faster. And we've now done this a couple times. I think about maybe one of my favorite examples of this. About 10 years ago, I read an article that a grad student at Berkeley wrote, this guy Noah Deich. He wrote an article about removing CO2 from the air, and that this is something that's critical to the climate equation. The IPCC says, hey, at some point, we need to start removing emissions if we're ever going to meet our targets.
Yeah.
And I sent him an email saying, like, well, what do you need to do to do this? And he said, the entire federal government is only spending about $10 million a year on this. And if we're going to get to any scale, this is going to be hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars one day. So Noah and I got together and I helped him start a nonprofit called the Center for Carbon Removal, which eventually became Carbon 180. I funded a scientific study at the National Academies to study carbon removal. I seed funded about a dozen companies that were going to build in the carbon removal space. And then eventually took that National Academy study to Congress and funded a bunch of congressional candidates to look at that, which eventually became many pieces of the IRA.
Inflation Reduction Act, yeah.
Yes.
Which had some of that. And so carbon removal is the idea that we kind of suck it out of the air because we're not going to reduce emissions. Behavior change isn't going to get us there. So we need this. I'm a bit of a skeptic about that. It's very expensive. And also there's concerns that it creates a moral hazard, which is, you know, the fossil fuel companies would love to have this. Like, we can keep on polluting and we'll make money putting it up there and someone else will make money taking it down.
I'm an all of the above approach kind of guy, and looking at the amount of shots on goal we need to take to hit our climate goals, we need everything.
Maybe a little bit of insurance policy, like,
or even if we do everything, we've still already polluted enough that we need to take CO2 out. We have to undo the pollution we've done in addition to cutting emissions dramatically. You know, the reason why I use this as an example is it was less about us controlling and driving something; it was really about recognizing the talent in Noah and what he saw out there and then giving him the rocket fuel and all the different tools in the tool chest to go accomplish his dream.
You also invest in Arena, which trains people to run for political office and disrupt the political landscape. So what are you trying to disrupt and how?
More talent. And you know, one of the things that my wife and I often talk about is, you know, can we bring in more new talent?
You think the old farts ought to get out of the way?
I think that some of their time has come, but also part of what makes a great democracy is new voices. And yeah, you know, we need more young people involved in politics. It's kind of an undeniable thing. And it's especially difficult if you have no background in it, no network in it. So you know, the reason why my wife Swathi created the Arena, why she was one of the co-founders there, is to provide a platform and tools for someone who has no experience in politics to get involved.
Right. The premise there is that younger people will bring fresh ideas, that they'll somehow be able to shake some of the incumbency and dissatisfaction so many people have with politics, because politicians are making promises they don't deliver on. People get disgusted with the system.
That's right. We started the arena back in 2016. And for example, Senator Andy Kim now was from the original arena class. And now he's a senator in New Jersey, or Lauren Underwood in Illinois, or Lena Hidalgo in Texas. There is a group of young folks who didn't have any political experience. And now many of them are in Congress, in the Senate, or mayors of cities. And some of them actually have run for president.
And so much of politics these days is performative, about, you know, showing up on social media, not necessarily governing and doing the hard work, right? So do you train them to be performers to get into office, or are you training them to actually, because, you know, running for office is, it's very different than the nitty gritty of like doing legislating and running a city or a state.
Yeah, part of the way I think about it is about talent. And when you think about talent in a company, you think about, you know, being a great manager, being a leader, how to build teams, how to run a business. That same ethos could exist in other parts of society. And part of the approach we take at Insight is, how can we approach talent and give them all the tools and, you know, leadership development and trainings and how to communicate, but also how to govern, how to build a team, how do you hire a team? You know, these are things that, especially if you're just entering politics, don't necessarily come naturally.
So how do you think about your own influence and power?
Oh, I tend to think about it a lot. I was raised with a pretty big sense of responsibility. I was the oldest of three boys. I had to take care of my brothers a lot. And when I had this big windfall selling Nest to Google, you know, one of the first things my wife and I did was put together our foundation and start to think about our impact. And
really, a lot of people just like, oh, I'll give it away when I'm dead.
I heard this from a lot of my colleagues too. Like, oh, or philanthropy is something you do when you're old. And, you know, we were 30 at the time. And one, like, our minds are still sharp and our networks are still really active. Like, now's a great time to get started with philanthropy. We attended so many of these giving pledge gatherings and those kinds of things. And rather than just pledge, we said, hey, how would you do the work? And if anything, I hope a lot of my very wealthy billionaire colleagues get the message and do more too.
Thank you, Matt Rogers, for your leadership and for all you're doing.
Now we're going to hear about a restaurant taking an innovative approach to reducing waste. Not by composting their leftovers, but by actually sourcing ingredients that would otherwise be left on the table. Climate One producer Megan Basilia has our story.
In the Mission District of San Francisco sits a funky, color-drenched explosion of a restaurant called Shuggy's. One of the dining rooms is entirely green. Walls, marbled tables, booths, even the 16 hand-shaped chairs sitting in the middle of the room. It's fun and moody. Kayla Abe is one of the owners. She's the creative genius behind the design and has worked in sustainability for years. She comes from a long line of farmers.
Somehow I thought that I came into food things on my own, which is totally ridiculous. And it is kind of cool now to return to the same field, but at a wildly different angle.
Shuggy's is a climate positive restaurant. That means they use ingredients other restaurants generally don't consider, like misshaped, off-color, or surplus produce, lower on the food chain seafood, and offcuts from local ranchers. They use things like spent oat flour, a byproduct of oat milk, to make their pizza crust. And they even serve up invasive species. Abe's partner, David Murphy, is the restaurant's co-owner.
Waste happens almost every step of the way in like the life of a vegetable or fruit or any food that's produced. The system is kind of designed in this really kind of screwy way. It's not about the benefit of the planet or the person. It's the benefit of the dollar.
For farmers and producers, it's often easier and more affordable to toss slightly blemished produce or meat cuts rather than figure out how to sell them.
It's like the three-legged carrot, like the wonky-looking radish.
Abe and Murphy pay farmers for these perfectly edible ingredients and make beautiful food with them. Today's menu features dishes like the spring fling, roasted sunchokes with an herby snap pea serrano emulsion, sautéed pea tendril, and a dilly sunchoke crunch. and the Bloom cabbage, made with Lonely Mountain Savoy cabbage, Asian pear, pistachio crumble, and a cured yolk.
Lonely Mountain needed to get rid of like 2 crates of Savoy. And like, we always show up at the end of the market on purpose. And we're like, okay, what you got?
And the restaurant has gained a lot of praise from diners. Shuggie's has been named on best new restaurant lists from Esquire, Bon Appetit, and the New York Times. Naturally, Abe and Murphy initially met at the farmer's market.
She was interviewing chefs for the newsletter that Foodwise puts out. And then I was like, oh, yeah, she likes me.
Abe had been working for an organization now called Foodwise, a nonprofit that puts on farmers markets and other educational programming. Murphy had been a chef for over a decade, working in Michelin and James Beard award-winning kitchens. They both spent a lot of time talking with farmers, and this reoccurring issue of food waste kept surfacing. They'd hear the same story again and again.
At the end of the market, he's like, here, take this. I'm like, wow, I don't need a ton of turnips. He's like, if you don't take it, nobody's going to. I'm either going to have to throw it away or compost it.
That was in the early to mid-20-teens, when more and more data was coming out around the implications of food waste. Project Drawdown ranked reducing food waste as one of the most impactful things we can do to fight climate change.
Not only was it this like larger existential issue, but farmers worked so hard and they were losing out on so much income from all of this product that they laboriously grew and harvested and transported to the market that is maybe slightly blemished, maybe is in excess. It just felt so sad and unfair. It felt like we should act and we could.
And it's not just upcycled produce on the menu. Shuggie serves up dishes like sustainably sourced arrow-tooth flounder and invasive species like wild boar.
Realizing that the wild boars in 56 out of 58 counties here in California, they root up more CO2 than any other wild animal here in the United States. They destroy entire habitats. They contribute to soil erosion. They just like destroy the earth. And that was a domestic animal that got loose and just turned feral. So it is incumbent upon us, because we let those guys loose. It's incumbent upon us to utilize them to create the demand.
The wild boar chop is served with roasted tomcod grapes, frisée salad, stone fruit, and black plum powder. When they first started thinking about Shuggie's, Abe and Murphy talked about going full vegetarian, but ended up deciding against it.
That is like absolutely 100% what's the best for the planet. But what we didn't want to do is alienate everybody else. We wanted to bring everybody along with us in this mission. If we structure this around things that people eat on a daily basis, and we show, hey, you can insert all this beautiful flavor and all this beautiful produce or all these different types of meats and offcuts and everything, and it's incredible and it tastes great, that is when you have success. That is when like what you're doing is going to speak to like the broader public.
Between their previous company, Ugly Pickle Co., and Shuggie's, they've diverted over 100,000 pounds of food from entering a landfill.
You don't have to be preachy. The food does all the talking for you. People are like, oh my God, this is, wow. What is it? When you describe the dish, you say, oh, it's a tuna rube crudo. And it's got, you know, this fun little tare on it, a little bit of pickled Thai chili. None of it sounds very food wastey. But then like the presentation and everything, when you go to scrape down the side of a piece of a skeleton of a tuna, you're like, wow, this is the craziest presentation of a crudo I've ever seen. And it's also beautiful, perfect.
Murphy and I went to the kitchen so I could see some of the food we'd been talking about, starting with the tuna rib.
I didn't call it tuna skeleton crudo. I didn't call it spinal cord crudo. I called it tuna rib. That sounds nice.
This is some of the best sushi-grade tuna that you can get, but it's still attached to the carcass, which is rarely, if ever, delivered to restaurants. Usually, they just get the tuna steaks.
But this thing that we just painted it down with is a stock that is made from all the rest of the parts of the fish. And then over the top here is some fun little crispy seaweed with some little rice puff.
Yeah, I've never seen anything that looks like that at all.
It looks like a sculpture of sorts.
Why have I never seen this in a restaurant before?
Because nobody ever asked the question. Chefs just aren't asking the question. I mean, they think that people don't want this kind of stuff. People don't want this kind of stuff because they don't know that it exists. And once you try it, you're like, oh my God, I want this. You know, I want this forever.
I can 100% confirm that it was absolutely delicious. Abe has spoken to Congress about food ecosystems, and she and Murphy want to work with other chefs and companies to help them incorporate upcycled ingredients.
The restaurant is our classroom. It's an educational space where we're trying to put this issue in front of people through their plates, and it is so much more dynamic than a bus campaign or like a government initiative, but the goals are the same.
And as they work on broader systems and behavioral shifts, Abe left me with some sage advice that we can all do now.
If you see something really ugly at the store, like buy that one. Buy the really ugly one that other people probably won't go for, because the other stuff will be no problem to sell.
For Climate One, this is Megan Basilia.
Coming up, a company using AI to help commercial kitchens reduce waste and improve their bottom lines.
So, you know, say, look, we have the taco beef and the chicken tenders. When you're serving taco beef, nobody eats chicken tenders. If you want to, like, waste less food and spend less time and money on something that's going to landfill, how about we think about changing your menus?
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Do you hear that? Sounds like breakfast is ready. Because Quaker's coming in hot with morning nutrition. 100% whole grain oats and a good source of fiber to fuel the rhythm of your morning and kickstart your day. And that sounds absolutely delicious. Fuel to start whatever's next. Quaker, official sponsor of FIFA World Cup 26. Let's go.
When you need to build up your team to handle the growing chaos at work, use Indeed Sponsored Jobs. It gives your job post the boost it needs to be seen and helps reach people with the right skills, certifications, and more. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need a hiring hero? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs.
Study.
And play. Come together on a Windows 11 PC.
And for a limited time, college students get
the best of both worlds.
Get the Unreal College Deal. Everything you need to study and play with select Windows 11 PCs. Eligible students get a year of Microsoft 365 Premium and a year of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate with a custom color Xbox wireless controller. Learn more at windows.com/student offer. While supplies last, ends June 30th. Terms at aka.ms/college PC.
Okay, so Ariana, quick story. The coolest field trip of my life was in fifth grade. It was in upstate New York, and we went, I guess you call it glamping, but this organization that took us, it was called Nature's Classroom. One of their big lessons was don't waste food, and they called it ORT. And I kid you not, to this day, when I think of food waste, I think of don't waste the ORT.
ORT, I literally had to look this up. It means a food scrap left at a meal. It is a great crossword puzzle word.
I thought they made it up, but it's, I guess they didn't. That's great. And you know what else is great? It was great to learn about the work of Topanga this week. It's a company that's using AI to reduce food waste in commercial kitchens. CEO Paige Schull says by predicting and modeling consumer demand, they can cut how much is thrown away by up to 70%. The company's also working to replace single-use to-go containers with reusable containers, starting on college campuses. Most people probably don't think about an economy built on dealing with trash, but it's huge, right? Like, can you just tell us what the scale is of the global waste economy?
It is huge. I agree. Trash is often an afterthought, but one way I like to look at it is we all eat and drink a lot of food. It's about $382 billion each year of food that is wasted before it's ever has the chance to be consumed. So to me, that's a pretty meaningful amount of food that's wasted and a meaningful amount of money. And there's a lot of other ways to slice and dice that.
So nearly 400 billion, like I think you said 382, and that's billion with a B, that is wasted every year. So this is just food that is made and then nobody uses it.
Yes. So that's a lot. That's roughly, 120 billion meals that are being wasted every year. And you put that into context with, okay, so why do we care? Well, if you think about, you know, 1 in 7 Americans, that's just in our country, are often living in hunger, there's a huge opportunity to kind of reclaim that lost food and replace it with folks who would love to eat it.
Yeah. So your company started as a milkman style grocery delivery service. What did that look like?
Looked like a lot of blood, sweat, and tears trying to figure out how to build and run a market. My co-founders and I, at the start of COVID, we were working in different spaces and we were really thinking about this trash problem. I think a lot of people can probably relate to all of a sudden they were ordering a lot more delivery and takeout and kind of watching that packaging pile up. And we started thinking, what's a world where that doesn't have to just be trash? So we were working with some local farmers in the Los Angeles area to procure their goods in bulk, package them in reusable containers in our market and send it out to customers. And we would pick up the empty containers each time we dropped off your next order. And yeah, that's where we really got to understand like how much food is being wasted, how much packaging doesn't have to be wasted, and all the good stuff that comes from diving in and trying to solve a problem.
You know, it's interesting because I feel like there's a good economic reason why milkmen stopped delivering milk in glass bottles like to individual households 50 years ago. What made you think that model could work today?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's like a few different elements of economic challenges at play. One is on the packaging in and of itself, which is that, you know, you have to be getting the same product each week in order for like us to drop off the container, pick up the container and be able to reuse it, right? There has to be some level of standardization. I think when grocery stores really became the norm of shopping, branding took over, every packaging needed to look and feel different. So that really shifted the usability. And then also like people started living further and further away from, you know, where they would commute and spend their life. And so the logistical side of going to each household to pick and drop something up just got a lot more complicated. But also there is a new way to build a similar system that reflects the world that we live in today. And packaging too has gotten a lot more expensive. You know, tariffs are real. Packaging is largely made overseas. It's imported. When you're looking at food businesses where it's a dollar and cents business, having an $8 meal where a dollar of that is a piece of packaging you have to pay for and it's just going to be used once, there's a huge opportunity to try and make that more valuable.
Yeah, when you say dollars and cents business, you mean like the margins are so slim?
The margins are so slim. And, you know, I think a lot of people who get into the food business, it's not a get rich quick play. It's because they love serving and delivering meals and experiences to folks. And so trying to take some of that pressure of the business and the economics off is a huge opportunity.
And most of your business, Topanga's business, is now on college campuses and you provide reusable containers. And more importantly, maybe you provide reusable container management for dining halls. So not just the widgets, but also the system that manages the widgets. Mm-hmm. Can you walk me through the life cycle of the package? Like what happens when a college student goes and grabs lunch and gets the container?
Yeah. Our goal is to make it as seamless as possible to get a reusable container. So, you know, a lot of college campuses these days, they're using platforms like Grubhub. So students can walk out of class, order their hamburger and fries to go, pick it up and be on their way to their next class. So we integrate within that system. Once a student places that order, we get a little QR code that represents who that student is, a lot like checking out a library book. The operator who's preparing your hamburger nice and fresh scans that QR code on the order receipt, scans the QR code on the container, checks out that container to the student, and then places it on the shelf for pickup. The student then picks it up, enjoys their food, gets a text from us saying, hey, welcome to the program. You have 3 days to return this container. Click here to figure out where to drop it off. And it's really pretty easy.
You have somewhere between like 97-98% return rate, right?
Correct.
How do you do that? Like, what? That's wild. That's so, like, especially for college kids, like they're returning their stuff 98% of the time.
Yeah, I know. It does. It shocks a lot of our clients during the sales process. They don't believe it until they see it. Yeah, I mean, it's super it's super kind of simple behavioral economics. And a lot of the frame is there's a carrot and there's a stick. And the carrot is that, you know, you won't be charged if you participate. We are tracking you. So there's visibility into what's expected of you. We can remind you when and where to return this piece of packaging. And then some of our clients like to also use the stick, which is if you don't return this container, there will be a late charge, a lot like a library book. By and large, we see those that choose to charge versus those that don't have meaningfully different return rates. It's really based off of what's going to be right for your community and your audience.
Oh, so even on campuses where they don't have the late fee, they still are able to achieve that 97-98% return rate?
Yeah, they are, which is incredible. You know, we do see a lot of campuses have campus ambassador programs or have, you know, sustainability clubs or dining clubs on campus that want to start to like be a voice and be spokespeople for the program, which is amazing.
Yeah. What do students say about using other students' containers?
Like, ooh, that's gross.
Yeah, yeah. Is it like a new that's gross? Is there like a ramp up?
I think that's a common assumption. But the reality is that we're all going to a restaurant and eating off of plates that have been used by others before. Same with the dining hall. The containers are going through the exact same cleaning and sanitization process. So it really is no different. I think it's once you kind of try it out, you recognize that. But yeah, I think it's a common conception because we think of to-go packaging as such a like one and done. We don't think of washing it and cleaning it and reusing it.
Yeah. You know, when I was in college, the dining hall was the center of gathering and you would go and there might be like different stalls, but you kind of just got a tray and often it was like restaurant dishes, like you're mentioning when you sat down with your friends. You know, it's been a bit since I've been in college. What's the vibe like now? I mean, is takeout just the norm where you're just taking it and leaving the actual dining hall?
It has shifted. It shifted a lot since I graduated, where you used to really just think of this like residential dining hall with these shared tables and buffet line. That's very much still alive and well. I think there is a lot more to go in that environment. So you don't necessarily sit and dine and chat. You kind of go grab your food and leave. But I think the biggest change over the past 10 years has been the rise in, you know, what we kind of term retail dining, where, you know, there's the Chick-fil-A on campus, or there's this Grubhub mobile ordering where you're intentionally ordering something to grab it as quick as you can and get on your way. So that has had a huge surge over the past 10 years broadly, especially over the past 5-6 years since COVID. And I think that is similar to what we were seeing at home when we were starting the Milkman's Market. I think schools started realizing, hey, look, all this packaging is filling our trash containers now. We have to pay more for dumpster and tipping fees. We're paying more for packaging fees. We got to figure out a way to do different.
Yeah. And of course, Topanga works beyond college campuses as well. And I'm wondering for you, what's the potential for similar reuse with partners like Grubhub?
Yeah, it's interesting. We have done a handful of like pilots and tested in more of an open market landscape with some QSRs and coffee shops.
Oh, can you pause there just for a second? Open market, you mean like a college campus is closed, like it's its own,
yeah,
it's kind of like you're at an airport, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like if you're at an airport, you're eating at the airport.
You're eating at the airport, right? Yeah.
Like you're there until your flight takes off. Similar with the college campus, like even if it's in an urban environment, you're kind of living in the same 5 miles for the majority of your time. Open market to me is more, you know, I live in Los Angeles. I live in Culver City. I don't go to West Hollywood very much, but maybe once a month I'm over there. You know, that's where it's kind of a little more open. And so that's where it's interesting from a, again, consumer behavior perspective of in that open market space, we saw that people who opted in, who were like, yes, I want to try reusables, had just as high return rates, 98-99%. But getting a critical mass to opt in was a lot harder. And also that logistics piece. Suddenly, like that person is now responsible for driving 10 miles over to West Hollywood to return the thing versus in a college campus, you walk down the hallway and you drop it off and like your job is done. So there's definitely different trade-offs. And I think it's really different depending on like where you live and what legislation is at play too.
So when you think about like a vision or just like the potential, when you look at partners that are functioning in these open markets, what do you see? Do you see it as still definitely a possibility, and it's more just about building out infrastructure, making behavioral changes?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a possibility. And I think it is just understanding what success looks like. I don't think it's necessarily a like quick win. I think it's an intentional, like, let's build a system that is going to work for years to come. So what you invest in it, you'll get out of it. I think there's a lot of great examples. You know, Germany has passed some national legislation a few years ago where every food service operation that offers to go had to present a reusable and a single-use opportunity for take it away.
I'm happy you brought that up, because that scaling element is definitely a thing that I think about, because single-use plastic, I mean, we know it's convenient, it's cheap, you can throw it away. And I think importantly, like you mentioned, most of our infrastructure is built around it, and you're asking people to completely change their behavior. So I guess in the Germany case, there is this example of, hey, it's going to come from law, you have to adapt, or at least give an option for it. So what's your counter argument to people who say, hey, listen, this is how it is, and reusable stuff is just too hard to scale?
Yeah, I mean, I think my honest counter argument is that if you think it's too hard to scale, then you're probably not suited to scale it, to be honest. I think it's like similar if you think about any major opportunities to try to do something different. It takes time and it is hard work. It's hard work to say, here is the new way of doing business. I think, you know, it's very similar parallels. If you think about electric vehicles, like all the infrastructure, you know, suddenly then, yeah, okay, we need chargers. And then we also need a system to make sure the chargers are working, so that somebody who arrives 100 miles at a charger that's their last chance for a refill doesn't get to one that's broken down. And it's kind of a full systems effect, and you have to think of it as systems change.
What do you think about the capitalism side of it? Can the circular economy be profitable?
Yeah, I think it definitely can be. Again, I think it is at its core, it's thinking through different economic models, right? And so when we're working with our clients, we're saying, hey, look, today you're buying 100,000 pieces of compostable packaging a year for 25 cents, you could buy 500 reusable packaging for 75 cents. Like, let's do the math. If those last for 1,000 times and you do X number of orders a day, think of how quickly, like, you've surpassed breaking even. And that's a huge opportunity. I think ultimately why a lot of our clients love the sustainability benefit of our two products, the cost savings, like, can't be denied. And same on the packaging side, that's the goal with food waste is, hey, look, you're wasting $500 a day on food that you don't have to waste. Let's like help you track it, mitigate it, and you'll get that back.
Yeah. And your company, in addition to the reusable packaging, you've been developing an AI smart scale to reduce food waste, particularly in like large institutional kitchens, of course, college campuses, which we've touched on, but also there are hospitals, there are hotels. How does that work?
Yeah, majority of food that's being prepared in these large kitchens today, people are going in, looking at what they need to make for the day and doing it. Sometimes there's an intervention at the end of the day where somebody needs to get out the pen and clipboard and write down, you know, X amount of taco beef, Y amount of cheddar cheese. I threw these all out at the end of the day. That's a pretty dated way of operating in today's world. So we've kind of introduced an AI computer vision smart scale that with a tap of a button, you put a tray of what you're about to throw away on. We capture images of it. We capture the weight. We're integrated with your menu, so we can say, hey, look, that's a taco beef. You wasted 20 pounds at lunch, 30 pounds at dinner. That's kind of what the capturing moment looks like.
Oh, interesting. So it is multiple things at once. It is not just an inventory system to be able to connect what you're making to what you're wasting in the ingredients. It is actually also physical, like a camera system that automatically captures that information for you, right?
Yes, it is also that kind of like data capture moment to replace having to ask somebody to
the pen and
down. Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And sure, we could tell you that you wasted 20 pounds of taco beef, but what does that do unless we tell you, and you're going to serve it again next Monday, serve 20% less, right? So again, the systems thinking piece, it's hard to say you just want to solve one problem without then suddenly realizing there's 20 other things that are related.
Yeah. When we talked about the reusable containers on the college campus, you used the example of like student A who always orders the hamburger on this day, and that can help forecasting for ingredients. Is that also part of the AI system that you're describing, or is that something different?
Yeah, exactly. It is part of that too. So, you know, say, look, we have the taco beef and the chicken tenders. When you're serving taco beef, nobody eats chicken tenders. Then we can help you understand next time you're planning a menu, if you want to like waste less food and spend less time and money on something that's going to landfill, how about we think about changing your menu? So based off historical performance and consumption.
Yeah. You seem like a great person to ask this next question too, and I'm really interested to hear your answer about it. I like many people, maybe yourself included, have reservations about AI. Right, a kitchen is a really human place.
Mm-hmm.
How does AI integrate with humans in your perspective?
Yeah, I think it's a really complicated question in today's day and age, to be honest. But I think it's a fascinating one and one that we should all be debating. From a kitchen perspective, you know, a lot of our clients have looked at or tested robots. So like a physical thing that is replacing the human and is frying the French fries. I think they found by and large that, sure, that's nice. It doesn't actually replace all the other steps to be done, right? They still need somebody to plate the French fries, to serve the French fries, and to confirm that there's no allergens. So where we see the opportunity for AI is for taking off the work that humans don't want to do or aren't best suited to do. So a lot of operationalizing a kitchen and reducing waste is just a data problem. It's understanding a lot of data, a lot of patterns, and what needs to change or shift. People don't want to work in a kitchen because they're data scientists, right? They want to work in a kitchen because they like food, they like serving people, they like that environment. So our goal is to make the data portion digestible and delivered to you so that you can focus on the side of the kitchen environment that humans love to be a part of.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Did you use digestible on purpose?
It's a good play in this world.
It's a good play. Yeah. Perfect fun for this. Paige Schelt is CEO of Topanga. Paige, thanks for your work and thanks for talking to us about it.
Yeah, thanks for the time. Fun to chat.
Hey, everyone. It's Ariana and Kusha. It's the end of our show, and it's time for Climate One More Thing. Kusha, what have you got this week?
Okay, I think you're going to like this one. Colorado just introduced a first-of-its-kind bill to legally protect beavers on public lands, and they're doing it as a climate strategy. So, right. That's what I thought when I read it. The idea is simple. Beaver dams keep land wet, and wetlands are less likely to catch on fire. And research actually shows that beaver dammed areas are 3 times less affected by wildfires than surrounding land. And the timing is important for Colorado because it's facing historically low snowfall this year, and wildfires have cost the state over $3 billion since 2020. So the beavers are a boon.
Beavers are an amazing species, and this is reminding me of an effort back in like the 40s when Idaho's Fish and Game Department was trying to remove some beavers that were conflicting with human habitat, obviously humans expanding into beaver habitat. So they moved them into a different part of the state, and they did this by parachuting them in boxes. Yeah. And then they found that, you know, not surprisingly, beavers are these incredible animals that restore watersheds and are very resilient and help with all kinds of ecosystem health. And so it was a good move, ultimately.
If a beaver had an individual parachute, I would want that to be like a mascot of a sports team or something. Like, what a cool animal that would be, with sunglasses and like a walkie-talkie. Anyway, we're getting a point. Hey, listeners, thanks for listening. Sign up for our newsletter. It's at climateone.org. Great stuff in there. Subscribe.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Austin Colon, Megan Basilia, Kusha Navadar, and Rachel Lacey. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Ariana Brocious.
Slow-loading screens and pixelated scenes.
With quantum fiber speed, you're finally freed.
Yay to you, the queen of stream.
More binging and gaming, you're living the online dream.
Downloads, uploads, all the things you can load.
Every series, all the shows.
With every gig, your legend grows.
Quantum fiber's love is true, yay to you.
Learn more at quantumfiber.com. Limited availability, service in select locations only.
The right window treatments change everything. Your sleep, your privacy, the way every room looks and feels. At Blinds.com, we've spent 30 years making it surprisingly simple to get exactly what your home needs. We've covered over 25 million windows and have 50,000 five-star reviews to prove we deliver. Whether you DIY it or want a pro to handle everything from measure to install, we have you covered. Real design professionals, free samples, zero pressure. Right now, get up to 45% off site-wide, plus get a free professional measure at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions apply.